Hello, and welcome to Once Upon a Time Walk. I'm back with Dave this week.
Hey, everybody!
And we are talking about, there's actually a lot of stuff that's been going on.
Yeah, there is.
Eldritch Moon is kicking off, and we are going to be talking about that. We have discussed some of the stuff leading up to it in the past. We finally get to actually talk about where that story is going, and I think Dave wanted to start us off here.
Yeah, so today was kind of a good day for me. A couple of exciting it was a good day for all of us, but a couple of things that happened today. So for one, we got the story Stone and Blood. Really fantastic story. One of the, in my opinion, probably the best one from the whole Shadows over Innistrad block. In my opinion, really good. I might be biased because one of the things that was so exciting for me was about a week ago or so, I wrote a post on my blog on Tumblr about, you know, somebody asked, hey, you know, I'm worried that it looks like maybe Nahiri is evil. You know, do you have any thoughts about that? And I kind of responded, well, you know, there's always two sides to every story. And, you know, here's how I kind of take Nahiri's motivation, and you know, so I won't recount everything that I say there, but essentially the story that we got today was, you know, pretty much spot on what I predicted and how I wrote it up. So that was very gratifying.
And yeah. Go ahead.
That's okay. I was just going to say then the other thing that I was even more excited about, which might seem weird because it was kind of a small thing, is back in May, I made a prediction because they had been really vague about when they were going to start revealing stuff about Eldritch Moon. And so back in May, I made a prediction that the spoilers and, you know, when they were going to start revealing stuff was going to be on June 20th. And my reasoning went, you know, look, it's Eldritch Moon. June 20th has a full moon. It is a Monday, which is a moon day. That's where Monday comes from, Sunday, Monday, moon day. Anyway, moon day with a full moon, and it just so happens that on the southern hemisphere, that is also the longest night of the year. Summer solstice up here in the northern hemisphere, winter solstice down there in the southern hemisphere. So I'm like, hey, longest night of the year for half the world. You know, moon day, full moon, Eldritch Moon, this has got to, you know, and it just lines up, you know, it was going to be late June that they were going to start revealing stuff. And I'm like, it's got to be, you know, June 20th. And there was a lot of pushback. Some people were like, no, it's going to be, you know, June 17th that it's going to get started. Other people said June 27th. And so I was like, oh, it would just be so perfect. Full moon, winter solstice, Monday. And today we got an announcement that there will be a video, the very first episode of Access Magic, kind of like Access Ooh. Hollywood, which I thought was kind of interesting. So the very first episode of Access Magic on YouTube will be, on Eldritch Moon on June 20th. So I was like, hey, so that was, both of those were very exciting. The reason that I say this is because as we talk today, And Adam, you and I were talking about this, how one of the podcasts that we had done, in fact, I think it was it just episode two of...
I think it may have been.
Our second episode. In any case, it was one of the early ones, and it was a lot of speculation, and I talked about why I thought that the threat for Eldritch Moon was not going to be Emrakul, you know, and I list off my reasons. You know, I think I had some good reasoning there, but it is looking more and more like I was wrong. I was just totally wrong in all of my predictions that I made in that podcast, which is totally fine. You know, sometimes I get to be right, and that's cool, and that feels awesome, like today, and then other times I slowly have to realize, nah, I was just way off. I was totally wrong on my predictions, and that's okay, because I like making wild speculations, and that's the fun of it all. But the point is, we like to make predictions on this podcast. I like to make predictions on my blog on here. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. We're not going for perfection, but it's all good fun.
Exactly. I think one of the things, especially one of the biggest, I guess, strongest elements to the whole it's not Emrakul theory was the fact that the argument that they were telling a mystery story through the Shadows of Innistrad block, and Emrakul was too obvious. But I will say,
yeah,
in the defense of many mystery stories, it is often the case that the suspect is the person that you least suspect because they're the most obvious person.
Yeah, that is true. And I will say, if you look back at my posts when Shadows over Innistrad was first being announced, I was very quick to say, hey, you know, what if the big threat is Emrakul? And like really early on, one of the cards that people was talking about was the old Mad Prophet card, where the flavor text is something about, you know, that's no, there's no heron in the moon, it's a shrew, a five-legged shrew.
With a voice like whispering thunder.
With a voice like whispering thunder. I was like, oh, it's Emrakul. And people were like, nah. And it's not that I necessarily think I gave in to what other people were saying, but I realized that more and more people, maybe it's the contrarian in me, but as more people started to say, oh yeah, it's looking like Emrakul, I'm like, let's not jump to conclusions.
Let's explore all our options here.
Let's not be hasty, little hobbit. Right, I really wanted to say, well, now it's looking a little too obvious. Like, you know, I want to read into the clues that nobody else is looking at, and suddenly it's like, oh, well, everybody's looking at the same clues as me, and they're all starting to think Emrakul. It's like,
yeah.
So maybe that was just me trying to be a little special snowflake. But in any case, I think we're both in agreement that at this point, it is really. I would be shocked if it is not, in fact, Emrakul that is the threat to be introduced in Eldric Moon.
I would also be shocked, especially. With the story today, Blood and Stone. Stone and Blood or Blood and Stone?
Stone and Blood.
Stone and Blood. With the story today, especially the way it ends, spoiler alert, as Dave said, Nahiri does return to Zendikar as the Hell Vault breaks and she's freed. One of the things, a slight detour for a second, I really liked about this story was the timeline. It helped clear out. We got explicitly the information that Nahiri and Sorin and Ugin helped trap the Eldrazi on the Zendikar 5,000 years previous to where our story is now. Mm-hmm. And we got to see for the first time, I think, how blocks kind of line up and how we get blocks sequentially, but oftentimes things are happening at the same time. So when Nahiri is freed and she returns to Zendikar, it's at the very end of original Innistrad block, and it's at, I would say, right before the beginning of the second Zendikar block. And so there's, 5 years? Four years between those two? In our time.
Right, yeah. Yes. So because when Nahiri talks to the Core on Zendikar, so this is right after she's been freed, they tell her that it's been a year that the Eldrazi have been loose. And so, yeah, I really liked that, that we can kind of look at that, and we can say, okay, so we know that in the story timeline, it was 1 year from when Zendikar, you know, the original Zendikar block ended, and when the original Innistrad block ended.
Yeah.
And now that I think about it, I'm trying to think, like, in real time years, how far apart those two blocks were.
They were, I believe, because it went,
after
Eldrazi, Skars, and then Innistrad, I believe.
Oh, was it really that?
Yes, I think
it was.
I guess
it was that close together.
Yeah.
All right.
But then the end of, because basically the end of the original Innistrad block is I think we can say approximately the same time as the start of the second Zendikar block, and there's a number of years between those two, and so I think people just, I especially assumed, I was like, oh, like there is a number of years while other things are happening, but we get to see no, like it's a period of maybe months between these two things.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really interesting way, and I really like that they're taking the time to kind of clarify things like that. The story did have, it had a, I guess, something that fantasy stories often do that get my goat. There's one scene where Nahiri arrives on Zendikar, and she travels to Balaged, which is the continent that has been destroyed so far. And she describes it as looking like the surface of the moon. How would she know? It raises so many questions on a fantasy level that, first of all, it implies that multiple planes, or at least one plane that she has been on, has a moon that she could visit. And obviously, old walkers didn't really go by the same rules of biology and physics, but it implies that in every plane there is a solar system, and there is a system of planets, and that there's more, and I think it brings it down on a fantasy level, and I get, for a lot of people, that's really fascinating. I think for me, the problem is that, like, it starts to mix too much with sci-fi.
Sure, well, and we know
that
that's...
I like to avoid crossing the streams, yeah.
Right, and we know that that's not the case. Kamigawa, for example, its moons rise out of the ocean.
Yes.
And we know that from Tamio and her talking about, moons being guided out of the ocean there. And so, I mean, it's a fair point, you know, how would she know what the surface of the moon was like, unless she had somehow, you know, been on a moon somewhere. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, there's always looking at the moon, but I mean, you do bring up a good point that
ultimately it's
it
a
is
small
odd
thing
to say it's like the moon when it's like, how do you know?
Yeah.
But
ultimately it doesn't matter that much, but it is one of those things that, if you're ever going to ask me to read the story, I will pick at things like that.
on the other hand, so, and this gets us off on a tangent.
Yes.
I'm fine with that. And that is, when talking about sources of colorless mana, I've often thought that probably the most common sources of colorless mana, other than, like, you know, wastelands and stuff like that, is when a planeswalker or a magic user is able to connect with a mana source that is celestial. So, like, soul ring.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the idea is that it is mana from a star that has, you know, somehow been condensed and accessed through this ring. You know, we know that meteorite, I believe, as a card, is able to produce colorless mana. Is it mana of any color?
I believe it's colorless mana. I can actually check because I am sitting near a pile of cards.
Nice. But, I mean, it does seem interesting to me, the idea that, hey, you know, perhaps planeswalkers, particularly old walkers, you know, were able to establish mana bonds with celestial bodies. And we know that somehow Sorin was able to get the silver from Innistrad's moon down to Innistrad. And as long as we're talking about old walkers, that's something else that I really liked about today's story. That, for me, it was probably my favorite part of the story, even though it was such an odd little... I don't know how many people focused on that out of the whole big reveal of the story. But this is the first time that we've gotten a planeswalker... who had been an old school plane walker before the mending, and, you know, from a first person narrative, you know, kind of going through their realization that they are no longer an old walker, you know, that, that something about the multiverse had changed, or yeah. something about, you know, them had changed. I mean, I was surprised that we didn't get anything about that from Ugin.
I think when
he came about, and we didn't get anything from a first person perspective from Ugin, probably because
no,
it's so enigmatic. And, you know, Nicol Bolas whined and complained a bunch about how, oh, you know, we were once gods. And, you know, certainly Liliana is like, oh, now I'm old now.
We get a lot of past perspective on it. I think we get a lot of, like, reminiscing from older planeswalkers, but we didn't, we haven't gotten that moment of, oh, wow, I am not what I once was.
Excellent point. Yeah, it's all retrospective instead of a current tense, a present tense experience.
Yeah.
And that was really cool to get with Nahiri's perspective in today's story, talking about how, you know, she had emerged from the Hell Vault, her hands were bleeding, and she tried to, you know, will them to fix themselves, and they didn't, you know, and she was different, and she could feel her pulse beating, and, you know, her body was no longer just an extension of her consciousness. And that was all cool, but what I really liked most of all was when she was talking about when the perspective was she was trying to planeswalk again, and she found that she could still access the blind eternities, but and I believe the language that she uses was before it was a soap bubble.
Yep.
You know, to punch through from one plane to another, whereas now it really was a barrier. It really was a wall. And, you know, how it wasn't her that had changed. It was the multiverse that had changed, and those barriers were firmer now. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, it kind of, I don't know if bug me is the right phrase to use, but I mean, it was hard to reconcile in my mind, like, okay, the mending happened, and then all these planeswalkers are now mortal, and I get, you know, from a storytelling mechanic why that was necessary, because they needed protagonists that were more relatable and, you know, not godlike beings.
Yeah.
But, like, trying to conceptualize, okay, but why? You know, why? Like, okay, maybe I can understand it having some effect on the multiverse, but why, you know, does it affect the planeswalkers? And when it talked about how the mending, you think about having, like, a scar on your arm. Like, you know, you have a wound, and when it heals, it actually mends, but in a way that is, it's thicker than before. It's, you know, the scar tissue kind of overcompensates. You know, it's not what it once was. It's
yeah.
It's more. And it's like when the mending happened, it wasn't just that act by those planeswalkers was just restoring the multiverse to what it was, but it was that scar tissue. You know, it was actually the barrier between worlds, between planes and blind eternities became, you know, thicker and firmer and harder to break through. And from there, we can say, okay, well, if that becomes true, then if that barrier is, you know, more impassable, more of a barrier, well, then it makes sense that planeswalkers can no longer as easily access, you know, their mana connections to all these different worlds, because it's no longer just a soap bubble that they are, you know, reaching through to access those mana bonds. It's a much thicker, more difficult barrier that they are accessing through. And even to the point of, you know, their consciousness, you know, the fact that reality was the bonds of reality were just so much flimsier before the mending.
Mm-hmm.
That planeswalkers, you know, being able to just reshape reality, you know, specifically their personal reality at a whim, you know, seems more plausible when back when the barrier of reality was so flimsy. Now that it's firmed up, you know, that is what's making them mortal. That's what's making them less powerful, is that their access to the multiverse has just been made a lot more difficult to access.
Yeah, I think also part of that, to me, I believe the reason I think planeswalking is easier or harder after the mending has a lot to do with what you said with the sort of like multiversal thickening. I think if we wanted to look at the multiverse as an organism on a grand scale, the mending is definitely like an internal after. Obviously, story-wise, we know that it was caused when Teferi and a bunch of other planeswalkers sacrificed their sparks so that we could heal the time rifts and whatnot.
Right.
And that it, story-wise, was a way to give us more relatable characters in planeswalkers. I think if you want to look at the mending as like an actual in-story thing that happened, that occurred, an event that changed everything, which it was, but we don't usually see it as that. We often see it as a storytelling storytelling tool.
A plot device.
Yeah, a plot device. And so I think from this perspective, we can see it really as like a reaction that the multiverse has, and it has not only a thickening of its skin to prevent planeswalking from being so easy and so easily abused. But also, I think that the spark used to be... I think a good way to put it is that planeswalkers potentially may have used to have gotten more spark in them. Like, their sparks were larger, and they allowed them to have incredibly greater power, and now that has all diminished, and that has a little to do with the thicker barriers between worlds, but also I think with just who they are as themselves. I know Nahiri said that she hadn't changed and the world had changed, but she does have the perspective of one person, and that is as she is just getting used to this. We have, as Nicol Bolas said, he has this whole thing about how we used to be like gods. So to have that exclusively be, oh, it's just the multiverse that has changed, I think I'd want a second opinion on that.
Yeah.
And as far as... you were talking about how it was great to get the perspective of planeswalker pre-mending, who now had to live post-mending from a first-person experience. And I think that we haven't gotten that from Ugin yet. As you said, Ugin is very enigmatic. I think the first time we get a full story from the perspective of Ugin, that will be a very interesting day. I definitely think that there are people at Wizards who have the skill to handle Ugin as a character and to present him in everything that he is. What I know I posted about this earlier, but what I'm really looking forward to is hopefully... I think my secret joy would be Ugin not yet realizing that his diminishment of power is permanent.
Sure.
I'm sure he's realized it in the same way that Nahiri immediately realized it. However, Ugin doesn't seem like the type to immediately jump to conclusions the same way Nahiri would or other planeswalkers would. I think Ugin would just be like, well, it could be a lot of things. A vast, like, sweeping multiversal change would not be the first thing he jumps to, in my mind. Definitely, he could chalk it up to, oh, well, maybe Nicol Bolas did something to me. I'm still recovering from my Hedron nap. So I think it'll be an interesting day when we get to see Ugin go up against another planeswalker and expect to completely crush them, and suddenly that's all thrown back in his face, and he has to deal with the fact that, while he's still very powerful, he is not what he used to be.
I can see your point there. I would tend to take kind of the opposite end of the spectrum view of Ugin. Not that he would be not as quick to come to those kinds of conclusions, but quicker. I mean, when he does emerge and like Sarkhan goes and talks to Ugin in the story where, you know, Sarkhan is figuring out what is going on in the world, how the dragons have taken over. And, you know, even his conversations with Jace in the battle for Zendikar storyline. He has, you know, I was going to say practically a superhuman. I mean, I guess it is technically superhuman ability to discern clues and information and, you know, jump right to the right conclusion. I mean, he knew right away that Jace was one of those that had freed the Eldrazi. He had never met Sargon before ever. Like, I mean, in the previous timeline, his ghost had kind of, you know, tormented or, you know, had led Sargon where he'd gone. But the real Ugin that we know in this timeline, you know, had never met Sargon, had no idea who he was. And yet he was able to, you know, say all of these really insightful things. So I don't know. I tend to think that he probably figured out and came to the conclusion even quicker than Nahiri did about that something about the multiverse itself had changed, because he seems pretty aware of his own limitations, his own frailties, especially after that big fight with Bolas, and, you know, having lost and nearly died. So, I mean, you could be right. And as you said before this podcast even started, one of the great things about having multiple theories tossed around in this in this podcast is, hey, one of us is going to be right.
That's true. If we both thought the same thing, we wouldn't really get anywhere with these. So
now, I will say one last thing about Ugin, just because Ugin really doesn't have much of anything to do with the Eldritch Moon storyline. But I will say that I highly doubt that we're going to see any stories from Ugin's perspective, at least for a significant
for a very long time. Yeah,
like I don't think that Ugin is ever going to be the protagonist of a story, the same way that, like, you know, Jace, or the way that it's looked like Chandra will be for the Kaladesh block. And the fact is, he's just not protagonist material. And it's not because he's a dragon, it's because he's so wise and so powerful. And it's like, you know, in a protagonist, you don't want Merlin, you don't want Yoda or Dumbledore to be your protagonist, because they're too wise. They're too knowledgeable, and you know, you need the young King Arthur or Harry Potter or Luke Skywalker to be the protagonist, because as my mother likes to say, and she's a writer and an English teacher as well, is, you know, look, you can have a character who is wise or good, but if a character is wise and good, then, you know, they need to be a mentor or something. They can't be the protagonist, because as soon as you have a character who is wise and good, they're just going to be an obnoxious protagonist. So that's not really magic related. That's just kind of overall story theory. So I'll leave that where it is. But I don't think we're probably ever going to see a storyline where Ugin is the protagonist, like the main protagonist.
No, certainly. I definitely, when I was talk about, I think it'd be interesting to see a story from the perspective of Ugin, I definitely don't mean like a block story.
Sure.
I'm talking like a one-off. I would expect eventually someday, probably, I'm going to say when Nicol Bolas comes back. I really don't think there's anything saying that he wouldn't. No, we haven't seen him in a while, which just makes me more nervous.
Well, technically, we haven't seen him in a while. We saw Raven Man just a few stories
ago.
That's
true.
I'm still holding on to the theory that the Raven Man is, to a certain extent, Nicol Bolas. So
you had some compelling arguments about that. I think we should save that for another episode, because there's some Nicol Bolas stuff that I want to talk about.
sure.
But right now we have, I think I want to go through one more theory real quick before we sign off. And I remember seeing this via you on Tumblr. I don't know if this was your theory or if it was someone proposed this to you.
It was not mine. Someone had posted it, and one of my tags that I like to follow, and every so often on Tumblr, I'll just do a search for a particular tag that, you know, I like to use, and I like to see who else is using it. So this was when I did a search for the MTG speculation tag. And I found a post that had only gotten one reblog, or it hadn't gotten a lot of attention yet. And as I read it and saw it, I was like, hey, this deserves way more attention than it's getting right now, because it's really compelling and really good.
Yeah.
And so I reblogged it, and it's been a fortunate thing for me that people have been generous in reblogging my stuff. So that's been neat. So anyway, no, it was not my theory. I'm looking it back up right now so I can say who it was. But you go ahead and talk about it, and I'll let you know as soon as I find that.
So while Dave does that quick bit of research, also, my research from earlier, Meteorite adds one mana of any color, not colorless.
There you go.
Yes, this theory in a broad sense states that they suspect that the town of Hanweir that we've been getting updates from in the form of a blog, we've gotten a few little story tidbits. It's those boxes, if any of you have seen those, like little
Hanweir
care packages.
Hanweir Chronicle.
Yes, the Hanweir Chronicle is the blog, and there have been little packages sent out to different people in the Magic the Gathering community, and they've kind of unboxed them and shown the world what they got, and it was all stuff involving the story of Hanweir, and specifically Shadows over Innistrad. And so the theory states that Hanweir and the people inside it particularly are slowly becoming one, and that they are becoming Emrakul. So you found it, so let's take it away
from
there.
So this was from the blog Color Pie Musings. Is their URL. And if you want, I think it'll probably be quick if I just read the text of the original post, if that's all right. So according to Color Pie Musings, after reading the collected Hanweir Chronicles so far, I now believe that something truly revolting is happening to the people of Hanweir. In one of his final entries, Oliver Hayfield decides that, quote, the only solution is to join with the rest of the sinners and wayward souls here in this hapless box we made, end quote. And that, quote, coming together is the only option, end quote. At first glance, this sounds like a simple call for unity among neighbors, but a few tidbits from his later letters point towards a more likely theory. First of all, on the need list is coat for eight. Yes, a coat, singular, for eight people. Then, the last thing we have heard from Hanweir, this hat does not fit us anymore. Again, we see a single article of clothing and multiple people. It's obvious that whatever is affecting Innistrad, cough, Emrakul, cough, is mutating the residents of Hanweir. Does Hayfield simply mean that everyone in town has mutated enough that the hat doesn't fit any of them? I don't think so. I think that the entire town of Hanweir is literally coming together. They are becoming a single Eldrazi monstrosity. And then Color Pie Musings asks for its thoughts.
My thoughts are that is terrifying. And also, the more I think about it, like, I think the more likely that is. And it's something that would be a very good way to close off a horror mystery block. I think a lot of people have been expecting Nahiri the Harbinger seeking vengeance for her plane to call down the last Eldrazi from the sky. Like, we have that whole setup with the Mad Prophet about, it's in the moon. And I think maybe she'll use the moon as a channel or something. But I think when it comes to Emrakul, definitely we have seen in a couple of places that Emrakul doesn't really create spawn of her own. She takes the biological things on the plane, be they plants or be they animals or people, and she turns them into her spawn. So I think taking that a step further and saying that she takes an entire town and turns them into a vessel of herself is just a truly fantastic and horrifying way to end off a horror block.
It is horrifying. Well, and I mean the Eldrazi enchantment back when we still had tribal, but the Eldrazi enchantment, Eldrazi conscription, had Emrakul in the art.
Yes,
and a person being Eldrazi under her sway. And I mean, I tend to think that Hanweir is not necessarily becoming Emrakul herself, but I do. I think that the idea of them being fused together, brought together through the influence of Emrakul is, I think, quite plausible and makes a lot of sense. I actually went a little bit further with my speculation, and I've been saying that just because putting a single Eldrazi card, particularly an Eldrazi Titan, alone in Eldric Moon would just seem mechanically so weird, like so out of place. A while back I said, well, you know, what if Emrakul's card in Eldric Moon was a double-faced card? And
yeah.
So Emrakul was only on one side of the card.
That's the idea I like, I think. That's... A good way, but I think a lot of people do complain when it became a little more obvious that it was probably going to be Emrakul. A lot of people were upset by the idea of it because they really didn't like the idea, as you said, of just like a standalone Eldrazi, and they thought that it was simultaneously like it was too soon to introduce one, and also it's the wrong place to introduce one. I think combining it with the I think it's perfectly acceptable, I think, to call flip cards or transform cards, like double-faced cards, the defining mechanic of Innistrad.
Right.
So, yeah, putting those two together, I think, is the perfect way to solve those problems.
And the whole idea that, look, you know, the Eldrazi are Eldric horrors. I mean, they were inspired by Lovecraftian kind of monsters who really belong on a horror plane like Innistrad more than an adventure plane like Zendikar. And I think that that's one of the reasons why a lot of people are kind of feeling so bitter about the Eldrazi right now is, you know, what people loved about Zendikar was the adventure world. And instead we got the Eldrazi world.
Yeah.
And, you know, so having a card that, you know, is maybe a, you know, five color mutant town on one side, and on the other side, you know, so like I made this speculative custom card called Hanweir, the Last Sacrifice, and it's a five color legendary creature, and I will go into all the mechanics because it's just a silly custom card, but then it has a mechanic where, you know, it can be transformed, and then on the other side is the Emrakul side, which is colorless. And I think that if, you know, if that could be pulled off, I think that a couple of neat things. One, it would make Emrakul actually seem to fit with Innistrad, because like you said, double-faced cards is kind of the big, it is the most iconic characteristic of Innistrad. And, you know, for people who love Commander and want to be able to build an Eldrazi tribal commander deck, and are like, well, we got all these Eldrazi from Battle for Zendikar that we can't put in, you know, a commander deck where Kozilek or Ulamog or any of the original Eldrazi Titans are the commander. Well, if you had, you know, a card that was a five-color, you know, mutant, something legendary creature on one side, and then you had the colorless Emrakul on the other side. Hey, that's, you can use that as a five color commander, and it still is an Eldrazi for your Eldrazi tribal. I don't know that that's what they're going to do, but I think it'd be pretty neat if they did.
Yeah, I think something like that. Obviously, it's hard to tell for us. We won't actually start getting spoilers for almost another week now. But I think this will be interesting to go back and listen to when all is said and done, because we're bouncing a lot of ideas around here, and I really like it. And so it's ideas like these, especially, that seem so wild and out there, but like kind of fit, and they fit just enough to be plausible. And those are the most fun to be like, yeah, you kind of called it there, but
and it's one of the things that for me is so much fun about doing a podcast like this, because you know it does allow us to go back and listen later on and be like, you know, you can listen to me like, oh yeah, you know, we actually guessed right on that, and then we say something like, oh, and the five color mutant is like, oh, just stop, Dave, stop right there, you were on a roll, and then you had to throw in the weird five color mutant wall.
So because actually you mentioned that. It got me thinking for a second, and so I guess my last question before we close off is, what do you think about, obviously, so we've seen some kind of corruption, Emrakul.
I'm not denying it any longer.
Yeah, so Emrakul's corruption.
Given up my contrarian ways for now.
Working its way through the peoples of Innistrad and changing them, definitely. So I don't think that we'll see a return of the Eldrazi creature type. I don't think we'll be like, oh, Eldrazi human, or Eldrazi sheep, or whatever they decide to stick it on. But
the Gitrog was an Eldrazi frog. Oh,
do you think we will see the return of the mutant type?
On Innistrad?
On Innistrad. In Eldritch Moon. Because I think you said it, and it sprung to my mind as something that would fit particularly well.
As a tribal, I doubt it. Like as far as a creature type that matters on Innistrad, I mean, I would see horror being more likely to be used. Mutant is typically used to indicate not so much mutations, but the idea that, like, oh, this is a merging of a couple of entities. Like, you know,
that's
the Cynic,
true.
And
yeah,
mutants all over the place.
In Magic, we tend to get mutant stapled to flavorfully attached to the idea that, like, this has been created artificially.
Right, and I mean the reason that I say, you know, mutant wall, that's specifically for Hanweir from the perspective of, hey, this isn't just talking about people that have mutated, that have extra limbs, or, you know, all of these crazy mutations or corruptions that we've seen in the Shadows Over Innistrad art, but actually talking about, you know, a group of people who are being fused together. That I could see as, you know, having the creature type of mutant.
Yeah.
But I think that more likely, you know, when we see these creatures that are corrupted, you know, we're going to see horrors, and that's what we've seen so far with, you know, Gitrog being a frog horror. There was the boar that I can't remember. It's green, and it's a boar horror, or as I like to call them, Kermit and Miss Piggy. I am really, really hoping that Eldritch Moon does have a bear in it, so that we can finally have our Fozzie Bear to complete the whole Muppet, you know, Eldritch Muppet collection. that goes into a whole side
Muppets. Yeah.
Yeah. They fit so well.
It was very clever.
Maybe sometime we'll have to do a whole a little piece on that. So there was actually one last thing I wanted to say about Hanweir before we wrap up. And that is, with that merging together, a lot of people were saying, like, oh, no. And, you know, admittedly, I was contrarian for a long time. It took me a while to come back to my roots and say, okay, I guess it really was Emrakul all along. And there are people who are still fighting against that. They don't want it to be Emrakul. And so a big go-to has been, oh, well, if they're coming together, you know, remember that Phyrexia is all about all will be one, and, you know, it's the Phyrexians. And I'm saying, no, I don't like to say impossible, but I find it highly improbable. I mean, for one thing, there's just no reasonable clues to lead us to the Phyrexians being at all involved here. It's a plane that doesn't have an abundance of metal.
Yeah.
Or, you know, any kind of magical technology, really. And, you know, it's not that the Phyrexians are incapable of grafting or merging or mutating things, but if they do, it's not a subtle, gradual process. It is, you know, there is probably a surgery or, you know, some kind of operation with jagged, ugly medical instruments involved in making it happen. Subtle, I'll say, changes that have been gradually, you know, happening to the people in Hanweir. Phyrexia is a lot of things, but subtle and gradual are not one of its defining characteristics.
Yeah, and I think that is the biggest strike against the Phyrexians, is that they're just... Once you get past the creeping oil stage, which, you know, we already have seen them get past, and they've developed these whole cultures now, is that once you get past that, they really aren't subtle at all. They are very obvious. the Scars of Mirrodin, it was, Mirrodin Besieged depicted a war between them. It wasn't a plague. It was a plague, but not in the sense of like, ew, what's going on? What could possibly be causing this? Everyone was like, oh, it's the Phyrexians. Okay. We have an enemy that we can fight. It's very obvious what's going on here. They're taking us over by force, and they're doing terrible things to us and making us these awful monsters, but not in the way that we're seeing on Innistrad. Mark Rosewater likes to tell a story about the idea he had for the the Scars of Mirrodin block.
Right. Yeah.
And this is every time he tells it, I have the same thought, and I'll get to that. But so the story is that they wanted to reintroduce the Phyrexians, and so they wanted to pull a kind of Planet of the Apes style. Spoilers about Planet of the Apes. they wanted to pull a Planet of the Apes style story going on there. And the third block, they pull back the curtain, and it was Mirrodin all along. And time I hear that story, I'm like, okay, here's how that would happen if you actually did it. You would say like, what the first set would be called New Phyrexia. And you would spoil one card. You'd spoil a basic land, and people would be like, oh, so New Phyrexia is Mirrodin, because the entire plane is metal. you can't hide that. You can't hide that everything on New Phyrexia just happens to be metal, and everything on Mirrodin just happens to be metal. I'm glad they scrapped that idea. I think obviously there are other reasons that they got rid of it, but I think that's something that might not have been considered. That's all I can think of every time I hear
it. Well, I mean, I can imagine where, you know, it was a really, you know, horrific
transformation.
You know, just horrifying landscape. I mean, yeah, it's metal, but it's like rusted metal and, you know, jagged swamps and, you know, I could see people being like, oh, you know, isn't that so creepy and corrupted and corrosive? But I mean, you make a valid point that as soon as they have like acidic myrrh or, you know, any kind of, myrrh, I should be saying rather than myrrh. For the longest time, I called them the myrrh, and I loved
the
fact that there was a card that was a shimmer myrrh. So, shimmer myrrh, shimmer myrrh, shimmer myrrh. And I'm like, Dave, that's mirror, actually. I'm like, oh, shimmer mirror. That's not nearly as much fun to say as shimmer myrrh.
Yeah. It doesn't roll off the tongue as easily.
Doesn't make me sound like I'm mumbling shimmer myrrh. Anyway, back on track. But no, I think you're right. I think that there are, you know, such, you know, iconic and clearly, you know, defining aspects of Mirrodin that, hey, how do you put it there and not make it, you know, so clearly obvious? But, I mean, ultimately, I think that the choice that they made to show the transformation instead of trying to pull that, you know, switch at the end was the right call anyway, so.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons, not just that one. All right, so.
The bottom line, I don't think it's the Phyrexians.
Yeah, I think at this point, as much as it might disappoint some people, I think the obvious conclusion is, and probably the one that Wizards has been kind of subtly pushing without explicitly saying it, is that it's Emrakul.
Okay, so here's, here's my very, and I will swear by the hair on my head that this is true, which doesn't mean anything. For those of you who don't know, I'm bald. So I swear this is the last thing that I'm actually going to talk about, and that is, so let's assume that Emrakul is, you know, the big bad threat that shows up at the end. So the other prediction that I made when I was talking about, you know, Nahiri's motivation and vengeance and all those great things that turned out to be today to be valid. So the other motivation that I made was that there's going to be a scene towards the, you know, at the climax of the Eldric Moon storyline where basically, you know, Emrakul is on her way, things have gone from bad to worse, and, you know, in so many words, Soren is confronting Nahiri, and he's like, please, you know, stop this, and Nahiri's like, you know, forget it, Soren, it's too late, you know, it's because of you that Zendikar is destroyed and dead.
And our representative of the Gatewatch.
Right. Well, because so far, Jace has done nothing useful.
He really hasn't. As
I mean, and that's not to be rude to Jace. It's just, I mean, from a storytelling perspective, his presence has changed nothing in the events of what's been going on there.
He is a vessel through which we, like the readers, can kind of get to know the story because everyone else involved kind of knows what's going on.
Right, and from a narrative point of view, that's not really where you want to be. You want your protagonist to actually be making a difference in the story. And so far, he hasn't, other than to observe things. And so where I see Jace actually mattering and actually making a difference is, you've got this big climax, and, you know, Nahiri's like, you know, forget it, Soren, there's no way we can work together, it's because of you that Zendikar is dead. And Jace is kind of like, actually,
about that,
not, yeah, right, about that. It's not actually destroyed. Me and a couple of buddies took care of it. And just kind of this moment of like, oh, crap. Okay,
yeah.
Well, you know, and you know, just kind of that moment of, I don't know if there's going to be any redemption between the relationship between Nahiri and Soren. I mean, probably not. But as far as being able to find some way to at least trap Emrakul again, if not, I don't think they're going to destroy Emrakul. I think that there's still going to be some ramifications of the other two Eldrazi Titans' deaths that need to be fleshed out. But I think it's pretty clear that Magic players are kind of sick of Eldrazi for a while.
Yeah.
And it's like,
that's safe to say.
Can be done with the Eldrazi for a time. And so I do think that this storyline is going to wrap up at least with a place where we're not constantly looking over our shoulders for Eldrazi all the time.
Yeah.
Because we just have to. It's just been too long and too much that's like, oh, it's all been about how do we get the Eldrazi back in their prison? How, you know, how can we, what are we going to do about them? And
we're ready, I mean, for new big bads, kind
right,
of a,
right,
a new threat.
And Kaladesh is coming up, and it's
exactly
gorgeous and beautiful and exciting, and we know it's the awesome set. And we don't want to go into that with, you know, extra Eldrazi baggage. So
yeah,
so that's my final prediction for tonight's episode or podcast. You may not be listening to this at night. You are probably listening to it bright and early at some point in the morning, dear listener. I don't know. It's nighttime for me and Adam. But bottom line, that is my last prediction, that there is going to be some kind of climax scene like that, like approximately that climax with Jace saying, oh, actually, Zendikar's not dead, and then that being Jace's main contribution to the Innistrad storyline, or the actual events.
Yes.
You know, and having an impact.
Yeah, so
that is my prediction of the night.
I would definitely agree with you there. And so I think that's safe to call that a wrap. More of the story, it looks like Innistrad is going to be shaping up to be, is talk to each other. Take that on. That's my prediction, at least. That's going to be the moral. And have a good night, everyone.